Introduce our tonight's speaker, Carl M. from Covina, California.
Good evening. My name is Carl Morris. I'm an alcoholic. I want to congratulate the birthday people. If you've ever wondered why there's no AA choir, you now know. I want to thank Bob for asking me. I have to tell you, when you get a phone call to say, would you like to come to speak in Las Vegas, it's a much different feeling than would you like to come to North Dakota in January. It's just feels better for some reason. I'm not really sure why. Monica. Actually, I could just say that I agree with everything Monica said. Good night. Oh, that was just wonderful. Really love to listen to you. Anyway, most important thing I can tell you about myself is I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I believe that I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. I have a very bizarre relationship with alcohol. Not much else than that. This bizarre relationship I have with alcohol takes on two forms, and the first part is that first part of my bizarre relationship with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink alcohol. Book calls it an allergic reaction. They describe this allergic reaction as having a symptom called the phenomenon of craving. And the best way I can describe this thing the book calls the phenomenon of craving is that when I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. Happens with nothing else, only booze. An example of that is they were kind enough to give me this bottle of water. And over the next 45 minutes that I'm talking with you, I'll probably drink half it. I don't know. If my mouth gets really dry, I might drink all of it. But I can absolutely promise you that after I finish that bottle of water, I'm not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in the hotel room. I'm not going to do that. I'm not. But if that's the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical thing that happens to me, if that's the only thing that made me that makes me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would wipe out alcoholism, wouldn't it? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, oh, no, and just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I have this other bizarre part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. I seem to have this mind that rationalizes and justifies my walk back to the next drink at all costs. And so what I've got is that I can't drink successfully because of what happens to me, this phenomenon of craving. I cannot not drink successfully because of this thing they call the mental obsession. I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. Ultimate catch 22 called alcoholism. If I could do either one of those successfully, that's exactly what I'd be doing instead of coming here tonight. Right? And I started this relationship with alcohol that I just described right when I first started drinking, and I started drinking a lot later than a lot of people in AA. I was 11. Monica really needed to be here at 11. Absolutely. And we lived in Seattle, and a typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner. It's about 10 feet off of the school property. Kids would hang out and smoke cigarettes, and we would also have like what I like to call the playground cocktail. That's a jar full of whatever we could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. Now, that jar is scary because nobody's been to bartending school yet. So there's equal amounts of whiskey, vodka, creamed mint, vermouth. There's green things floating around in that jar. And you can imagine a bunch of us 11 and 12-year-olds choking that down 7 in the morning and passing that around. And, of course, it was the early 70s, so we were smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit? Yeah. Hang on. We don't have time for that. And it was even before Ziploc days, when it would just be a regular Glad bag, and as you'd roll it up, there'd be about 9 people spit on it, like, oh, man. You pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen, or if we were really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. Were you guys there? Now, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous often interrupt themselves and they say something like this. I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I totally understand and respect what they're attempting to do. They're trying to protect singleness of purpose. Absolutely vital aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous should never be forgotten. That aside, I still think it's a bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. We don't have time for this. Come on. See, I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other. In fact, the most bizarre example I've ever seen of that, a number of years ago, I was in this speaker meeting, much like this, and the speaker that night was just giving one of the most heinous, ugly, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm in a speaker meeting and the drunkologue starts to get ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. And I think that night I was on the edge of my chair, drooling, looking up at the speaker going, "Yeah, buddy, go, 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 go." And at one point in this really ugly story, the speaker said, "You know, I had 4 DUIs. The judge said if I get one more DUI, I'm going to prison for sure." Sure enough, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway in a blackout. I hit a family of 4. They all wound up in the hospital. I wound up in prison. In prison, I sodomized, man. I was sodomizing. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. We don't have time to laugh. Come on. So, by the time I'm 14, I'm the neighborhood drunk. I'm the neighborhood drug dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister, and he didn't find anything funny about this. You know, and my parents, good, solid people in the community, and it was no secret to them. I mean, I'm withering away right in front of their eyes. By the time I'm 14, you know, my hair is long in front of my very bloodshot eyes, and I'm locked in my bedroom listening to Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, getting all of the necessary tools for living. And, you know, my vocabulary is, whoa, wow, right? And they really tried to help. They tried to help. But you see, they always blame my problems on people, place, and things. They didn't understand that I'm an alcoholic. They figured, you know, if we can get him away from that damn group of kids he's hanging out with, things would get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things would get better. They tried all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. See, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. Right? So by the time I was 17, maybe 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle, and my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. If we can get them out of Seattle, things would get better, so they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and in that 3 years, I got approximately 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content is what was going on. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. They would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas, and as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. Second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company as the human resources director. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this. She saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman with a very full life. We're very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We're very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. Long story short, it's about the same time a drug deal went really, really badly. It was a really bad night. I joined the Navy. What I'm about to tell you should scare the daylights out of you, but on my way to the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAP test, and this should scare the daylights out of you, but this test qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should scare the daylights out of you, that the United States Navy has a test that somebody like me can pass, and the Navy would even think maybe, possibly, or even remotely about putting somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that test. It's called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Can't do that. Through a series of events, I was kept in the Navy anyway. They took away that nuclear status, thank God for the United States. They kept me in as a conventional electrician, and a year and a half later, I was a lower rank than when I first came in. Here's the deal. Here's how that happens. When I would be out on that ship in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I would stand there on the deck, and I'd look around, by God, I'm on a big gray ship in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. By God, I'm in a uniform. No doubt about it, I'm in the United States Navy. However, that ship would pull into a port. I would leave that ship and take a drink. I would totally forget that I'm in the United States Navy. And I would come back to where I had last seen the ship when the drunk was over. And I don't know whether, I don't know how long the drunks are going to last. Are they going to last 6 hours or 3 days? I have no idea. And it's a very strange feeling to be in a foreign country on a large pier at 6 a.m. and you're kind of standing there going, there was a destroyer here the other day. One Monday morning, I'd been drinking all weekend. I was driving my car into the base. My car is being held together by rubber bands, and I got a bottle between my legs. It's early Monday morning. I'm late to get into the ship again, and I'm trying to just get a few hits off that bottle so I can make it through at least half the day until I can figure out some excuse to go back out to the car to get another drink. And there's this guard shack at the front of every Navy base where a Marine stands duty. If you're going to bring your car into the base, you have to pull up at this guard shack. You need to show your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything's in order, they will flag you through, and you can go park your car on the base. This particular morning, I guess there was a depth perception problem going on. The Navy still insists it was on my part, not the guard shack. But it's kind of sketchy, but I remember seeing the Marine stick his head out of the guard shack. I could see the whites of his eyes. He had a very startled look on his face. And I looked down, and I'm still going like 35, 40 miles an hour. I tried to swerve. The car hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped over, and bam, right through the guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. Marine was all right. I was being patched up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they were reading new charges on me. And this is nothing significant. This is nothing new. New charges. I mean, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days. It's just no big deal. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed Anabuse. They sent this prescription back to the ship's doctor, and every morning before quarters, I would have to show up at sick bay, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested into my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this disease called alcoholism. That is, I had developed a mental obsession and a spiritual malady so severe that no amount of discipline from the military, no amount of information I could get from the Navy psychiatrist they were sending me to every couple of weeks, no amount of love from anybody that may have still cared about me was going to overcome what I was facing. And you know what? I didn't even know what I was facing. All I know is that over the next 7 to 10 days on this Anabuse, I slowly went insane. I remember counting those days on that Anabuse just... been 4 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on Anabuse. And I started to look around that ship and the other men. They're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. Only with love and tolerance in Las Vegas, I'm sure. On the 10th day, I just snapped. I went AWOL from my ship, and I locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel, 4th and Broadway. It was $13 a night then in 1986. It is now $13.95. Checked just a couple of months ago. locked myself in that hotel room, and I got a bottle of vodka and a shot glass. I remember sitting on the edge of the bed, and this bottle is sitting on this rickety little end table there. And I remember looking at the bottle of vodka, and I remembered that when the Navy doctors had prescribed the antabuse for me, they had given me a very stern warning. They had told me, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle of vodka, and I thought, well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get. I took one shot, and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. I got to tell you, this is a very sick group if you think this is funny. I actually have proof of this. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor and his sponsor, real sticklers about the amends step. And one of the amends that I had to make that I could not make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for that bachelor's degree. I either had to pay them back for it or go get what they had paid for in the first place. So that's what I did when I got out of the Navy. That's how I wound up in the town of Covina. That's where I signed up to take this telecommunications bachelor's program. In the first couple of semesters, I had to take basic courses and stuff, and one of the courses I had to take was this thing called a business presentation course. It's just like a speech class is all it is. And in the first couple of days of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students, throwing them up in front of the room, giving them a topic to talk on for a couple of minutes, and they had to do this off the cuff. And the instructor was just doing this to see what he had to work with for the semester. After about five or six students were thrown up there, he pointed at me. And I walked up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, talk about a bizarre situation in your life. So I told them about drinking on top of antabuse. They did not respond the way you guys responded. They were like, there were, though, a couple of guys in the back that went, right on, man, right on. So anyway, I'm red-faced, hyperventilating, sweating. I'm back in the hotel room. And I take another shot, and up it comes. My late sponsor, Eddie Cochran, calls this thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. Just straight up and out. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is a type of hotel room where the toilet's in the same room as a bed. But I found the magic of drinking on top of antabuse that if I would hang in there and keep drinking and keep puking and keep drinking and keep puking for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, enough of the antabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating. I already told you, I'm all right with that. Right? So if there is anybody that's new or fairly new and you are still on antabuse, I want you to know you can drink on top of antabuse. However, you got to get two things going on at the very same time. First thing you got to get going on is you got to hang in there. You really, really got to hang in there. And at the very same time, don't die. If you can get those two things going on, have at it. I drank on top of antabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. There's no other way to describe it but desperation drinking. That's just not the only way to describe it. My second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in National City. It was one of those mornings where you come to and you look around for evidence, right? Where am I? Everything all right? This particular morning, the last thing I had remembered was blood and sirens. And the next thing I knew is I came to and first thing I saw is evidence of a very bad night. That is men and women with surgical masks and tools in their hands. That is evidence of a really bad night. My last night of drinking, I'm being led out of the San Diego jail by a shore patrol, being transferred from civilian authorities over to military authorities. I'm in handcuffs. I'm being brought up to the quarter deck of our ship early in the morning. And that morning, the officer deck put his arm up and said, orders have already been processed on this loser. We are not to accept him on board this ship. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. And I'm standing there in handcuffs. Lots of authority figures standing around. And apparently, some sort of option was thrown out on the table. I do not remember as I stood there in handcuffs thinking, oh, thank God they're giving me this treatment option. I am so at the end of my rope. I don't remember thinking that. Nor do I remember thinking or feeling, oh, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can beat this rap too. That would have been a more likely thing, but I don't remember thinking or feeling that. I now know that it just would not have mattered what I was thinking or feeling, because I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience in handcuffs was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, not once did they ever turn to me and say, "So what's your opinion?" Right? It just never goes that way in handcuffs. Right? It just doesn't. When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And I was taken up to this treatment center up in northern San Diego County, Miramar, and when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. That is who Carl Morris is without Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what society thinks of Carl Morris without Alcoholics Anonymous, that they are willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me. Now, I did not know a little piece of information about handcuffs. I had always viewed handcuffs as just sort of a minor, temporary interruption to a drunk. Right? This is always the way I regarded handcuffs. I didn't know, and maybe if you're new, you don't know this either, but I was about 6 months sober when I was told what the truth about handcuffs are. The truth about handcuffs are that they are a symbol from the society we live in, where the society we live in, this is what society is saying: excuse me, but we don't even trust you with your own hands. Did you know that about it? I didn't know that. I did not know that. So I'm in this treatment center, and everybody that showed up over the next couple of days, we're going to all do this 45-day thing together. There's about 35 of us. And nobody's talking. They got us in these group therapy sessions. They're trying to get us to talk to each other and trying to interact, and everybody's just arms folded, looking at the floor. Nobody's really excited about this whole thing. And this facilitator is getting more frustrated. You know, by the second day, it's really frustrated. Nobody's interacting. Finally, this guy from some other base that was in this group with us named Paco, he raised his hand. Says, "I'd like to say something." The facilitator gets really excited. "Oh, yes, what would you like to say, Paco?" And he says, "I hear I'm supposed to be rigorously honest if I'm going to do this staying sober thing, and I would like you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a street name that I use whenever I get into trouble, and this looked like trouble, right? But my real name's Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on?" The rest of us looked up from the floor just enough to say, "Yeah, whatever, Randy. Nice to meet you." We looked back down at the floor, but this facilitator got really excited and said, "Oh my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs." Later that afternoon, Randy was paraded right in the front of the rest of us. They slapped a gold name tag on that said Randy. Then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. Randy took his job very, very seriously. About the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I know is that we'd been in this place 7 days, and they said, "Civilian clothes, parking lot, 6 p.m. Five white vans pulled up. We were told which van to get into, and each van took off into a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere in San Diego. And the van that I was in, sure enough, pulled up at a meeting much like this one, and we, about six or seven of us, sat in the back, and you guys started your meeting. I remember a few things from this meeting, not very much, but I do remember, as I sat there, and I listened to, it must have been a participation meeting from the podium. Everybody that shared at that meeting got up to the podium. The first few people read, and then the rest of them just seemed to talk off the cuff for a few minutes each. And as I listened to you guys, what you were reading and what you guys shared, I believe I heard what Alcoholics Anonymous wants any new person to hear. As I sat there, I was sitting there thinking, "Oh my God, they know. They know. Jesus, they know." Now, if you would have seen me there thinking and nudged me and said, "What is it that you know that you think they know?" I would have said, "I don't know. But I know that they know." And what it was is I was identifying with the two things we want you to identify with in Alcoholics Anonymous. I identified with the way that you drank, and even more importantly, when you guys started to describe this soul sickness that happens when you're not drinking. You describe it as restlessness, irritability, discontentment, a spiritual malady. She described it beautifully right out of the big book there, where just absolutely unable to function on this planet. This feeling that there's this tight spring in your belly, you're about ready to explode, and the only relief you get is to take another drink. Right? And I heard that night. The other thing that I heard that I will never forget, I have never heard the alcoholic mind described better than I have in the last 19, I've been here 19 years and 10 months. I've never heard the alcoholic mind described better than I did in that very first meeting. This guy got called on. He walked all the way to the front. He introduced himself, and he said one sentence. He said, "My name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation." And he sat down. And I was just like... I didn't know that other people knew this. Right? Next night, went to another meeting, and I got really confused at this meeting, because everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. And the more they said that, the more confused I got. I was sitting in the back saying, oh, for Christ's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Jesus, loser again. Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? So I'm back at the treatment center the next morning, and I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us, I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. Now that kind of worried me, because now she wants me to focus. And they still had me on anticonvulsant medications, and it's hard to focus on those things. If you've ever been on those, you know what I'm talking about. Field of vision right about here is just fine, but there's dancing squiggly things over here, and you're like, whoop. And now they're over here, and you're like, whoop. Right, so if you're ever in a meeting and you see somebody new, they raise their hand, they still got the hospital bracelet on, and they're kind of like that, you know what's going on. Anyway, she says, Carl, let's play a game. Imagine this. Imagine I walk into this room, and I have a tray. And on that tray, I have a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately. Oh, I take them all. And she snapped her finger. Settle down. Play the game. Focus. As my eyes came back into focus, I go, what? She said, you can't have them all. You can only have one. Which one would you take? I thought for a second. I said, well, I guess if I can only have one, Mary, I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, well, then maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? I said, no. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of this place, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. Now I'd have enough money to buy a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. We don't have time for this. The only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is sobriety dates. Right? There's only one sobriety date. If there's lots of people in this meeting, I know, that love to work with new people, and I know you run across this scenario like I do at my home group back in Covina, where you see some new guy around for a while and go, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And every once in a while, I get this response. Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 3rd. My pot clean date is May 2nd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. Then they usually say something like, need your car worked on? No. I know you have a lot of parts. I'm sure you do. Only one sobriety date. One sobriety date. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety date. Same scenario. Saw this guy around my home group for a while. Went up to him and said, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And he said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night. So now I have 89 days. I had to think about that one for a second. I was like, huh? I think that kind of falls in the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes. If you're new, sobriety dates are also international. So anyway, after 45 days in this place, they're going to let us out, just what the orders were, and they're going to let us out on this Friday. And the Wednesday before the Friday, they're going to let us all out. They gathered all 35 of us that were going to get out of there, whoever was left. And the biggest, meanest counselor in the place, and he was a Marine, and on that day he's wearing his full dress uniform. And I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform, very impressive, very intimidating sight. And we're all sitting there in the room, and he marches in from the left side and comes up to a podium and grabs both sides. He doesn't say a word. He just stands there and stares at us. And we're all like, huh? I mean, it just goes dead silent in the room. And he just pans the room and stares each one of us down. And he finally speaks. He says, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. And through the years, our statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Jesus. Then he said, many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to our statistics of this treatment center, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. And if you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could hear a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. By now, he's the poster boy of the treatment center, for Christ's sake. So on this Friday afternoon, they're letting us all out. People are being taken back to their ships, bases, and commands in various different ways. But there was about four or five of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown in there. So we had to wait on the front doorsteps of the treatment center for about half an hour for our cars to be brought out an impound lot. So I'm standing there with about three or four other guys, and we're standing there kind of looking at each other, sea bags at our feet, you know, and one of the guys points to the other edge of the parking lot. There's a car coming across the parking lot. He goes, "Hey, is that Randy in that car?" We look a little closer. Yep, sure enough. Got a little closer. One of the other guys says, "He's drinking already." Sure enough, he's got a pint. He's just polishing it off. He rolls right in front of the doorsteps, rolls the window down, throws the empty right at our feet. Crash! We look up. He gives us all the finger and drives right off. Guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember that day, I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach, north end of San Diego. And the truth about, I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, I don't know a soul. The truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink or a drug. I got a lot of information, and I'm physically feeling better than I have since I've been a young teenager, but there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I'm in a very dangerous spot, 45 days. Information. Physically feeling better, right? If there's ever a turning point in my life, it's right there at that meeting at 6 p.m., North Shore Alano Club. One guy that night, operating in his primary purpose, leaned over to me, nudged me, and said, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, because I promise you I would have lied to him if I would have thought for one more second. And I said, "You know, I don't know, buddy. I just got out of a Navy treatment center 3 hours ago. You got me. I don't know what I'm doing." His eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break, he's fighting his friends off. I got him. He's mine. Right? I didn't know there's guys in AA that lurk around meetings looking for new guys that will accidentally admit they don't know what they're doing, right? But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular weekend that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. So he's wondering what to do with his weekend, homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman. Just insane. In between the meetings, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car, and he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting, right? And he'd be sitting there, and he'd be yelling at me. He'd say, "You got to go to the meeting. You got to read the book. You got to get a sponsor. Damn her! Got to go to the meeting. Got to read the book. Damn her!" And I'm like... Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so glad that that guy that night was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, understood and had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that this guy was not a guy in AA who had been sitting around twiddling his thumbs. Now he's in pain, and he thinks his solution is, you know, underneath his covers, whining into a sponsor's answer machine. "She left! Call me! Where are you? God, save me!" Right? I'm so glad that he was out dragging my sorry butt around. Right? We sometimes give the new person or the fairly new person the wrong impression as to what their solution is going to be. We always say, and rightfully so, call your sponsor. Right? But there is no magical sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, if we only just call our sponsor, we would not all be sitting here. Just a little piece of AA history before I go into this story is November 16th. I'm trying to do the math. 1950, Dr. Bob died today. This little piece of AA. But Alcoholics Anonymous was founded on the basis of Bill Wilson, 6 months without a drink, pacing the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio. Another business failure, thinking of drinking. He did not get on the phone and call Ebby and say, "Ebby, get over here to Akron and save me." Did he? We would not be here if he had done that. He knew that his only way out was to find a newer person. And it's very easy these days to find a new person in Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? We all know how to find a new person, don't we? You go to a meeting, and they raise their hand. They raise their hand. Right? And by this guy doing this weekend, by taking me to so many meetings in that same area of town, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw other people that were at multiple meetings that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. But I saw other people that were at two or three meetings over the weekend. And what I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, make another plan, and they do one play. Well, that's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the game around here is one day without a drink or a drug, you are a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. We go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this, try a little of that. And we run right back in here. And we huddle up. And we go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And just before we break, some guy in the corner might go, wait, hang on. Hang on, I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broken. I'm bored. What do I do? Some old timer will get up and say, son, get a job. Break. And we go out there and we try a little of this, try a little of that. Got back to my ship after that weekend, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on that ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. Had 14 months, and he was caught fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, and by God, he was going to carry the message to me whether I wanted it or not. I am so grateful for this man for many, many reasons, but the main reason is he was living a way of life that was extremely valuable, life-saving valuable, because all he had to do to save my life was to stick out his hand and say, come do what I'm doing. He did not need to rearrange his life to accommodate this new guy that didn't know a damn thing in order to save my life. But he was doing it because he knew that he needed to do it to save his own ass, right? He didn't know whether I was going to make it or not. In fact, he was convinced I would not, right? But he became my first sponsor, Bob W., and for the first 6 months, he was hounding me about going to, you know, he took me to a lot of meetings, went to meetings, kept hounding me about the book, and I would avoid that. I can't even tell you why, I just did. I think it's because half the other meetings in San Diego, they were just doing that. And when the ship had to go out to sea I was about 6 or 7 months sober, but in that 6 or 7 months, I would be sitting in meetings, and if you said something clever, funny, or insightful, I would get this feeling like, oh, thank God, Sammy said something. And I could breathe again, and I didn't even know I was short of breath. Dying of untreated alcoholism, expecting you to put a Band-Aid on me when I came to meetings. But you might find me in the middle of the night, either there on the ship holding my gut, or maybe in a hotel room off the ship holding my gut saying, oh God, it's back. It's back. What's the matter with me? And I'm even more confused now because I'm sitting and going to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? But I don't understand the fatal nature of alcoholism, that as the days tick away and I'm sitting in meetings and I'm doing nothing other than just sitting here, I am slowly dying of untreated alcoholism. Ship had to go out to sea for 21 days straight. My first sponsor, Bob W., told me that I needed to meet him in the aft end of the ship, way down in the engine room, every night at 6:30 p.m. First night I showed up, he had this book in his hand. He said, come on, I've been hounding you about it. Carl, have you read it? And I said something stupid like, yeah, sure. There's like How It Works and We Antagonists and some doctor with some opinion about something. And he saved my life out of his ignorance. He was no expert at working the steps. I was the first one he ever worked with. And he saved my life out of ignorance because he didn't know what else to do but to open up the book and start reading. And then when he got tired, I would read. And he shared the minimal amount of information his sponsor had shared with him, and he was doing his damnedest just to do the best he can, right? And I got the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous right there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, down in an engine room, basically just one guy named Bob W. that was desperately trying to save his life, no idea whether I would make it or not, and I've heard it put this way. He was doing what he was doing not because I was alcoholic, but because he was alcoholic, right? And when I took the steps there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, right out of the book, I did not get a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience as the book promises. I got what is described in the appendices under spiritual experience called a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I was put in a position to then find the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous when I worked the steps. I did not get the real gift of Alcoholics Anonymous until I did something else, until I ever so feebly, tried to do with someone else what he had done for me. I also learned an extremely valuable lesson about my responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous if I have found this solution. And I'm reasonably armed with some facts about myself. I have a responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous because nobody but us can help us. Right? No one else But a sober alcoholic armed with facts about themselves who's found the solution can carry a message of depth and weight in order to bring about the necessary change in the other person. All the other most esteemed, educated positions in society cannot help us. One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no other person on this planet can. How I learned that, I will never forget. Shipboard into Victoria, British Columbia. My first sponsor, Bob W., and I would often split a hotel room when we got off that ship, just to get off that ship, because there's 300 men on that ship. And so we would split a hotel room. We would find the AA meetings in that town. This time in British Columbia, we did the same thing, got a hotel room, and we went off to the AA meeting hall. And after the meeting, Bob said, "I'm really kind of tired. I'm not feeling that well. I'm going back to the hotel room." I stayed out with the AAers for a couple more hours. I came back to the hotel room a few hours later, and there's Bob. He has found this guy from our ship named Blair. Blair was hammered on the street, just up against the wall. Bob had carried him up into the hotel room, propped him up against the headboard with pillows and an end table, and Bob was reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to him. Now, I look at this scene, and I think, this is ridiculous. Blair's in a blackout. Blair's like, rarely? But Bob's going at it. I chimed in a little bit, and anyway, Bob then took Blair off back to some other hotel room, and didn't hear much anything from Blair for the next couple of weeks. We're back in port, back in San Diego a few weeks later, and 3 a.m. in the morning, and I'm in my rack in the ship, and all of a sudden, "Carl, wake up, wake up." "What? Whoa, 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 what?" "It's Bob." He goes, "Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We're going to get him." Apparently, over the last couple of weeks, Blair's tried to drink, tried not to drink, tried to drink, tried not to drink. He's at the jumping off point. He's on the Coronado Bridge. If you've ever been, if you know anything about the Coronado Bridge, it's an extremely popular suicide spot. In fact, it's so popular that they actually have a suicide hotline phone up at the top, just in case you have a little change of heart, right? And Blair had gotten onto the suicide hotline phone. And this is what Blair was apparently saying to the very well-qualified suicide hotline counselor. He was saying, "I will only talk to Bob W." Now the counselor is saying, "Who's Bob W?" Blair was saying, "It's anonymous." They kept hammering at Blair, and they found out he was from the Navy and what ship he's from. So suicide hotline phone people call down to the quarterdeck of our ship at 3 a.m. They go, "Is there a Bob W. on that ship?" Now, Bob, he'd guard your anonymity, but he did not guard his own at the level of that ship, so he could be of service at any time. So that guy answering the phone at 3 a.m. said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps. We know all about him. They go down to get Bob. Bob comes and goes, car, wake up. All right, so we hop into Bob's car. We start driving down to the base of the Coronado Bridge. As we're driving down, Bob says, "Carl, grab the Big Book. Bone up on working with others." Like, oh, okay, it says, "See your man alone if possible." Says, "Forget it, we're going to wing it." We get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that San Diego County has available for an emergency situation like this, they're all there. Paramedics are there. Police department's there. Fire department is there. On-duty psychiatrist is there. And Bob and I walk up on this scene, and the fireman who seems to be in charge says, "Is one of you Bob W.?" Bob goes, "Yeah, that's me." He goes, "I don't know what you're going to do, but we've been talking to him for an hour and a half, and he ain't budging. But go ahead, give it a try." Hands him this little telephone contraption, and Bob says into it, "Blair?" And you can hear on the other end, "Bob, is that you?" Bob says, "Yes, Blair, it's me, and I'll get the hell down from that bridge." You hear, "Okay." One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. If you are an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, remain an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's an extremely valuable way of life. Whether it feels like it this year or not, it's an extremely valuable way of life. After 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy, moved up to Covina. I'd already said you'd go to school and stuff, and I'm puttering, still starting the same car I got sober in, and putter, little Volkswagen hole in the floorboard, had to push start the thing, and pulled into Covina, and I had already, Bob and I had both agreed, he was still in the Navy for another couple of years. They had to go off to the off to Asia for like 8 months. He said, "Carl, you need to get another sponsor." And so I was thinking that maybe I'd do that sooner or later, but what I really needed to do was get a life. That's what I was thinking as I'm puttering on up to Los Angeles. Boy, do I need a life. You know, I'm 2 years sober. I deserve better than this. Damn it, I need a life. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to work. I need a life. I'm going to stop by meetings when I get a chance, but I need a life. And I pulled into the 502 Club, the San Gabriel Valley Alano Club, for a noon meeting, and I met the guy that was going to be my sponsor for the next 10 years. His name was Eddie Cochran. He was making coffee at that noon meeting, and he had a medallion, said 1951, which I added up and said, by God, he was sober 10 years when I was born, for God's sake. And he said the exact same thing that one guy said to me fresh out of treatment. He said, hey, never seen you before. What are you doing? And I said, it's very nice to meet you, sir. And it's nice to see where the meetings are, but I'm going to be going to school and I'm going to be working. And it's nice to see where the meetings are. I'm going to stop by some meetings when I get a chance. But I need to get a life. And he just sort of chuckled. And he said, son, school and work, that is wonderful, but that's what we do in between meetings. He was giving me the secret to life, that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visit Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? And the first thing he told me I needed to do was put new people in that car. And I said, sir, I have to push start that thing. There's a hole in the floorboard. The new guys might fall through the damn floor. But I tried it. And he told me if I did that, my life would get better, and I didn't see how, but I did it reluctantly. And the very first night I did it, by God, I found out Eddie was right. Remember after the meeting, the very first night I put new guys in that car, I realized my life had gotten better. I looked over my shoulder, and by God, the new guys were push starting my car for me. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. I have run out of time because you guys interrupted me too much with laughing and stuff like that. Here's the bottom line. I love being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't picture my life not being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't even imagine not being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the bottom line is, if I were to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, the best thing that could possibly happen to me is I make it back. So why leave in the first place? God bless. Good night.